We do have a quorum. We'll call a meeting of the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee to order. And before we begin, I just want to point out that you have a nice book in front of you that was prepared. It's full of budget documents, and that's yours to keep. And if you want to leave them in the committee room, that would be the advice we have, but you can also take them back with you to your office. Just remember to bring them back next time we meet. So, there's also a spreadsheet, I think, in your packet that Mr. Berg has prepared. And that's also a good thing to have. And we appreciate him doing that. I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes from February 15th.
Mr. Chair, on the I'd be happy to have the minutes on the 15th, and then I have a question as well.
Okay, a motion been made by Representative Atkins to approve the minutes of February 15th. Any discussion or questions? Does it relate to the minutes?
Not to this particular set of minutes.
Hearing none, all those in favor of the minutes, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question does relate to minutes. Are there minutes for last night's meeting? Traditionally, do we get some minutes to vote on? Because there obviously was a formal meeting, and I assume somebody kept minutes and track of the votes and so forth. Will we get that yet today?
The Senate was primarily keeping track of all of that, so I'd have to check with the Senate. I assume that they would have that record. We'll check on that. Ms. Novak?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, traditionally there are not minutes that are done for the regents, for the Joint Committee. There's no mechanism for the Joint Committee to meet again and approve the minutes. And so they haven't been kept in the past that I'm aware of.
So, if Ms. Chair, Ms. Novak, if somebody wants to review what happened, what would they do? Go to the tape?
It would be recorded. I think that would be the option.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Novak, if there was to be a motion to reconsider, that would occur today, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Atkins, I don't believe this committee could reconsider an action of the Joint Committee. The Joint Committee would have to meet again, would have to be called to meet again. There is a report that's issued by the Joint Committee to the full Joint Convention, and at that time there could possibly be a reconsideration of the report or a... I don't know how a subset of the committee could take an action that review an action that a full committee took.
And that's, since that committee has adjourned, I don't know how that would work.
Mr. Chair, that's why I inquired. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding, though, that the rules set out that there are actually two committees, our committee and their committee, meeting individually, that there's a majority vote required from each individual committee of eight members. So I was just curious how one would go about making a motion to reconsider. I wanted to make certain that I didn't let that opportunity go by, because there will obviously be a motion to reconsider after what happened last night. I assume you share in that desire, Mr. Chairman.
Desire to what? To reconsider?
To reconsider what happened last night.
I don't share that opinion, no.
Okay. Mr. Chair, would you, can you tell me, please, prior to last night's meeting, was there a meeting of eight or more GOP members to decide upon who to vote for the at-large seat?
Not that I'm aware of, and I guess I'm not sure why this time is where we're going to be discussing this. This is not on our agenda today.
The reason I ask, Mr. Chairman, is because we had the meeting last night. This is the first meeting to follow that meeting. If there was to be a motion to reconsider, this is a place where it would be raised. It was just I found it quite interesting that an individual that wasn't even up for the at-large seat was, and it fell into place so automatically that individual received every GOP vote. Earlier in the evening, I had inquired about evidently a secret meeting that was held among GOP members from the 2nd Congressional District, to which I wasn't invited, where the tradition has been that you invite all legislators from a congressional district. Look at it with the benefit of reflection over the last several hours since last night's meeting. It just didn't strike me as the right approach that was taken last evening. I'd appreciate your input, but can you tell me how it came about that even though Representative Broad was not even a candidate for the at-large seat, that suddenly every GOP member voted for?
They were all, according to the rules, as you remember, they were all eligible to be nominated in that at-large position as long as they were not one of the other finalists or selected members.
And, Mr. Chairman, I don't take issue with that. It was remarkable to me how once the vote, even though Representative Broad had not even been discussed as a possible candidate, suddenly every GOP member voted for Representative Broad, who I like, who I came in to service with back in 2002. Something just didn't quite feel right. And I'm just curious how that came about, where every member suddenly decided on the same exact person, even though the possibility hadn't even been discussed here in the open setting of the meeting last night, Mr. Chairman.
Well, as you said, she was a very well-liked individual, and that had to be part of it. Maybe I take some responsibility since I cast the first ballot for her, that others felt probably that the chair had her as a preference, although I had not indicated that. So I don't know what more I can tell you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel.
I'll address that a little bit, Representative Atkins. We did not talk or confer with the chair on that vote, and so when it was brought up by the other senator about the option, I felt free then that I could vote for whoever else was on the slate, all the nominees, and so I too, that's why I voted for her, and that is the truth, whether if you believe it or not. That is the truth. We never met together. So,
and Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, if that's what you say is what occurred, I absolutely do believe you. I have every the highest regard for members of this body. I'm just telling you that from an outsider's or somebody who wasn't involved in that decision-making process, but to start out the evening finding out that there had been a meeting of the congressional delegation from the 2nd District, and then to hear that no decision, no recommendation was being made, and to hear from a different legislator that, in fact, there was a recommendation that was supposed to have come from the 2nd Congressional District, and then to hear a senator say, oh, no, there was no recommendation, I just start to get a little sense of that there might be something more afoot. And if for the folks that were sitting around the room last night, I know that when we walked out of here, there were a lot of folks that really called into question how this Board of Regent election is taking place. And for the first time, I've never seen a Board of Regent. In fact, Representative Rukavina 2 years ago told me, we do not politicize, we don't make this a partisan exercise. And to have last night that smacked of as much partisanship as I have ever seen relative to a Board of Regent election. So it may not have been intended, Representative Vogel, and I take you at your word absolutely. But it certainly came across that way to a lot of people other than just me. And I thought perhaps, Mr. Chairman, that I was a little hypersensitive because of the being excluded from the 2nd Congressional District's meeting. But then afterwards, when I talked with others, they were reading it exactly the same way, that the fix was in, that the vote had been rigged, and that we shouldn't cast that sort of shadow upon these terrific folks that are about to serve on perhaps the most prestigious and important volunteer position and volunteer board that we have in the state of Minnesota. I apologize to the folks here waiting to testify, but it struck me as too important of an issue to just let go, Mr. Chairman.
I think if we were to go back, we'd probably do some things different. The Second District did make an attempt. I'll just add that all I understood is that they were going to try to get a caucus together. I didn't realize it was just GOP members that were invited to those first two meetings, and that didn't lead to another meeting because they apparently couldn't agree even among themselves. So anyway, enough for that, and I'd have to just end by saying that there's always been a little bit of politics in this process, which we've tried to eliminate as much as we could each time we go through this. Representative Merrill.
Well, did you want to go, Representative Merrill?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, I guess I take offense to that because I did some research. I met with the people that came into my offices, and, you know, I know District 8, they had a meeting together, and I don't know how many were Republican or how many were Democrat up in 8. We don't know the numbers there. They did endorse a person.
Weren't they all invited, though, Representative Detmer?
I have no idea. And normally it's the senior legislator that calls a meeting. I don't know who's the senior legislator in two. I think you are, but
not by a long stretch.
I don't know.
I got 30 more years to go before I be the senior member.
But I was around the last time the elections were taken, and I had some feelings like you have. How things were handled, and I just feel that people voted their conscience, and if we feel that we want somebody in there, we have the right to vote that way. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Demmer, I think what I heard Representative Atkins say to Representative Vogel was he respects that you have the right to vote, and I don't think I didn't hear Representative Atkins calling any individual into question. I just want to reiterate that. But, Mr. Chair, I just want to be clear. Your understanding up till the meeting last night was that the second congressional group that met had not arrived at any decision.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
That's the truth. I think at this point we need to change the subject to our guests here who are here to testify.
I
didn't see you sitting there.
Forego the whole discussion other than to say I was totally disgusted with what happened last night, and I'll leave it at that. But you were around a couple years ago, Representative Detmer, and the congressional districts nominated their people, and the ones that they nominated won, and two of them happened to be Republicans. Known Republicans, and we had the same majority, in fact, a more overwhelming majority of members in the House and the Senate combined than you do today. We didn't do what you did, and that's fine. You know, what goes around comes around, and you guys got to live with the fact. But to take Regent Hunter off that board last night in the manner that you folks did was a little embarrassing, and you know, the fact that now we have two former legislators on the Board of Regents that just retired recently, I suppose that's maybe a good thing. I don't know. Maybe they'll be as partisan at the Board of Regents as they were when they were legislators. So, But you can't rewrite history, Representative Detmer, and what happened last night was not what happened 2 years ago when you were here. And there's no way you can argue that it was.
We need to hear from the Office of Higher Education at this time. If you're still in the mood. we appreciate you being here. Sorry we're a little late in getting your testimony started, but we do appreciate you being here. Ms. Wright, would you begin? Or
he said they didn't make it. Yeah.
Chairman Norris, members, thank you for this opportunity to present the budget for the Office of Higher Education. My name is Sheila Wright. I'm director of the agency. I have colleagues here with me today, but before we get into the details of the budget, as a preliminary matter, you have before you a letter that was distributed on behalf of all agencies, including the Office of Higher Education, regarding the details of the budget. What we will do for you today is walk you through those details. Before my colleagues begin, let me briefly say that the budget calls for $171 million reduction. This includes $152.7 million reduction, 6% to the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and University of Minnesota, and also an $18.2 million reduction in programs administered by the agency itself. Of critical importance is the recognition that this budget takes into consideration that we have reached a juncture within higher education where we must protect critical services, most namely the state Minnesota grant opportunities for our students that provide financial aid. You heard many of the state projections on Tuesday along with testimonies as to how critical this is to our students, especially those who are lower and middle income students, in providing access to education. It helps us protect the promise of education, which is a part of the mission of the agency on for our citizens, and also ensures that we have a steady stream of people who can enter the job market capable and ready to maintain that core. In addition, we believe that anything less, anything more than a 6% reduction to our two vital systems, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system and the University of Minnesota, would place those agencies in a critical juncture of protecting their academic core. And these two systems, coupled with other colleges and universities throughout the state, provide the engine that drives our economic system and attracts businesses to the state. Anything less than 6% would also would place them in a place where they would have to maintain or increase their tuition. So this budget takes into consideration the two points that are most concerned to our students, which is their financial aid and tuition increases. And also with their academic core, we recognize that the University of Minnesota provides a critical and vital space in the state for research, along with Minnesota State Colleges and University, in providing Greater Minnesota a large range from certificates, associate degree programs, and also a viable system for providing critical areas such as teachers. These two systems are similar but uniquely different, and we must at this time protect their future and the quality of life for all Minnesotans. And we believe strongly that the budget before you accomplishes that while also addressing the critical realities before us, which is a $6.2 billion deficit. With that, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Dr. Mark Mizukanis, who will walk you through some of the details pertinent to the budget.
Welcome, Mr.
Chair and members. What you have in front of you that's from our office is a legal-sized document, back-to-back. We've tried to put this together. We don't have an overhead or presentation today on the government's budget. We tried to put it in front of you in the simplest terms in the clearest terms that we could. This is why we have the simple document. And if I may, if I can start on the side that has governor's budget recommendations, February 15th, the University of Minnesota, Minsky, and the medical school on there. And as you can see, what's shown on here is simply the base funding for the upcoming biennium, the biennium you're making a decision on, the reductions that are recommended in the governor's budget. As Director Wright said, these are a 6% reduction from that base. And again, the appropriation is in the last column. This has been broken down through the various appropriation levels that the committee typically uses in the bill itself, the omnibus bill. So it goes to operation maintenance, ag and extension services, specials, the rest of the specials, health sciences, the IT, the system specials, and the U of M partnership. So it's essentially a reduction that's across the board to each of those various specials. I would simply point out there's a footnote on there just to explain it so that there's no confusion about there. There is some funding in the medical education research education fund that's over in the health department that also has some changes to it that affects the university's budget. So that's something that you would be made aware of. At the Minsky, again, it's very straightforward. We start with the base for the current, for the upcoming biennium. It's a 6% reduction. And I haven't shown, or we have not shown the detail in the various areas because it's a bit difficult to determine what the base is given all the changes the last couple of years. in those in central office and the learning network. But again, it is a 6% reduction in the appropriation recommendation. And then the Mayo Medical School has no recommended change to it.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, then for members, just simply to flip the page over to the back side, this includes the changes to the recommendations in the Office of Higher Education. There's a bit more detail here because these are obviously programs that we operate and have much more of a direct impact on. And we've added some comments to let you know what the impacts are. These are essentially comments that you have in your budget documents already, that the documents produced by Minnesota Management and Budget, but we've tried to summarize things here. Let me point out the bottom line number, the $18.2 million, the reduction that Director Wright for the buy-in indicated is not quite a 5% reduction. That was essentially a target 5%, but this is simply a rounding number, so I think 5% is the right way to think about this. And I'll go through these, maybe not each of them in detail, but to point out some of the major changes. Again, as she mentioned, the state grant program has no recommended reduction to the base. You see a slight increase of $200,000 for the biennium. This is related to the Safety Officer Survivor Program, about six lines below that. It shows an equivalent decrease of $200,000. The idea is simply to move the appropriation for that program underneath the state grant. To retain all the eligibility of the Safety Officer Survivors Program, but not to change that eligibility. This is simply a resource change. It has nothing to do with the program itself. The State Work Study is a program that in the agency that is taking the largest reduction. You can see there about $9.8 million for the biennium, roughly 33%. This will result in fewer awards to students across the state, but this is a bit hard to tell. We've used a number here, but often institutions backfill with their own institutional aid on work study. There's federal money available on work study as well, so we've used a number here, but you should know that it is subject to some kind of adjustments by the institutions as they receive funding funding from the agency. The chief scholarship in this budget is recommended to be eliminated. You see the $4.7 million for the biennium, that would be zeroed out going forward. As you recall, I think it was last week we were before you explaining the program, and we had a report that was done back in January and showing you over the last 3 years what the change in the enrollment has been and the spending out of that program. The Minnesota College Savings Match Program is a program that's been around for about 10 years or so. What you see there is about $1 million reduction for the biennium, 75%. The $350,000 remaining there is only for fiscal 12, and that is simply to make sure that the commitment made to families and contributors during the last tax year is met. So this is a payment that actually goes out in July of this year immediately, but it's for tax year 2010. So commitments were made to those people as they made those contributions. So the idea was that those commitments would be met, but going forward, the program would no longer be operating. I'm sorry, this is just the match program, but the 529 program still stays in place. I think you got some information, received some information a while ago, that there's roughly $800 million of assets in that program. So that continues, the tax advantages all continue, the investment process all continues. This is simply the matching part of the program. The post-secondary child care grants, reflects a 5% reduction. This would lead to about 150 students not receiving grants going forward. The American Indian Scholarship Program, again, a 5% reduction. This program is a first-come, first-served program. There is a waiting list of about 500 students, so this would add to that waiting list. I've already mentioned the Safety Officers Program. The agency administration, again, as all the other programs, was a 5% reduction. We have kept open positions for the last year and a half or so. That would just continue. This is one way we would meet that. And we have combined some the way we do things in the office. Our accountability work is now done with a group of people, a team that in the past had a separately identifiable person doing that work. The Manitex Minlik Library Programs, again, 5% reduction. This is a pass-through grant that goes from us over to that program. operated by Bill DeJohns, related to reduced services, fewer databases, jointly purchased, things of that nature. Reciprocity, and this is a real important one to point out, because there is no reduction to this program, but this is something that either you fund it fully or you don't because of the nature of the contract. This is money that is appropriated and goes to North Dakota, the students that go to North Dakota, vis-a-vis those that come from North Dakota to Minnesota. So this is one you can't take money out of it, otherwise you do not meet the contractual obligation that we have with North Dakota. I should add, too, Mr. Chair, that this is a program that is very difficult to forecast. There's been a lot of money moving around over this last couple of years. And I think we had indicated that we needed to transfer some money in the current biennium to meet some of the obligations for that program. The Midwest Compact is a appropriation of roughly $95,000 a year. This is membership to MEC, the Midwest Higher Education Compact. Again, this is something, this is a fee that we pay to them, so to reduce it would be simply to mean that we'd have to still pay the fee amount, it would just go to somewhere else in the budget. Then the next few, the parent information outreach, get ready programs, again, roughly 5% reductions in those program appropriations. The Minnesota Minority Education Partnership, no recommended change there. It's a small amount that actually has a large impact for that organization. And then United Family Practice is another program that's recommended to be reduced totally. These are funds that go to United Family Clinic. They're for residents to subsidize about 18 residents in that program in St. Paul. And then finally, the ICAP Intervention for College Attendance Program, again, no recommended reduction in that program. So,
well, thank you. I have to say I really appreciate the form that it's in. It's easy to see and read and follow, and it's very clear. Any questions, Representative Plowski?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the overview. Assuming that there is no new revenue, what would the recommendations of the governor be for higher education if the revenue side of his budget is not funded? You've got a 6% more or less reduction across the board. How would that change?
Who would like to respond?
Right now, what we're...
Ms. Wright?
Excuse me, Chairman Ornes. Right now, what we have before us is a budget that we believe protects that academic core. We, of course, would have to go back and make adjustments to our plan. Our team is looking at various scenarios and have looked at various scenarios. We believe that the budget before you represents the best case scenario for protecting the academic core with the tuition increases, along with tuition, keeping tuition costs down, while also providing for the financial aid that's so essential. Our office is really trying to protect the promise of education. Education is important and critical to the economic engine of the drive of the state, so the governor would have that in mind as we move forward.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the answer, but again, if there is no new revenue and you're going through scenarios, what would be the next step if there is no new revenue to cuts to higher education? I know the PR. I have it. Now I want to know where we go next if there is no new revenue. Does this go to 12? 8%? Where does it go after this?
Anything Chairman Nornes, anything above that would place the institutions in a real critical state of being able to provide the services that they have before us. Relative to our agency,
Representative Perlowski, one thing that maybe I can draw back these to the agency side of things is that we did try to prioritize. We had sat around, talked about principles, and what how do you approach this process? But it's going to be a hard one for everybody. It was a hard one for us, and you can see that it was the work study that ended up taking the biggest hit. That's not easy. I know that's very sensitive to various members. But the idea was to prioritize. So that's we have these some principles that we're operating from. We don't have them ready right now, but we did operate from that premise in the first place. And you can see, too, that some things are simply zeroed out. The idea was is that it's important to keep doing what you think is important well as opposed to doing things across the board.
Okay.
If there are further reductions, I suspect it would be something along the same line as Director Wright said. I do know that, you know, we had to make some planning discussions earlier on. I know that the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system have been thinking about this for 6 months because I attend their meetings, and they are already thinking about what they would do. I mean, that's up to for them to decide, but and it's hard for me to speak for them. But it's
well, Mr. Chair, I realize the programs, and I've counted four that you've zeroed out, and I assume that there would be more that would probably have to be zeroed out in your office. But if I flip the sheet over, I then have the University of Minnesota and Minsky. And again, my question is, if there is no new revenue and you work with $6 billion across the board, what is the plan of your agency to propose to the legislature cuts to the University of Minnesota and the Minsky system? Or is 6% it? Is this where the governor digs in and says, we're not cutting anymore? Or are we going to go deeper? And how deep? I'd like to know.
At the moment, we're not prepared to answer that question for you, but we would obviously have to make adjustments to the scale that we have and would have to adjust accordingly within the agency.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to just do one more here. I would hope that you would present before the budgets are done in this legislative session in the House and Senate a scenario where there is no revenue. And then tell us what would happen under such a budget so that we would know what the consequences were of a no-revenue increased budget on Minsky, the University of Minnesota, and your agency. I'm concerned about those programs, too, but the big knife would fall in the University of Minnesota and Minsky. I assume you must have done it. I would hope Minsky is doing it. I would hope that you is doing it so that we're not surprised when May comes. And there are other budgets before this division.
Chair.
Ms. Wright.
Chair Norton. The two systems are most assuredly looking at various scenarios. And so only time will tell with how that works out. I can assure you, though, that if the cuts are really deep to the two systems, we would place our systems in great jeopardy for providing for that quality of life and for the economic connections that they make. This means the academic core would be breached. At both of those institutions, we're reaching a point where they've received reductions for a number of years. Right now, the state enjoys high-quality education in both systems. One of the systems, the University of Minnesota, is nationally and internationally recognized and attracts the economy here. So I ask, from the Office of Higher Education, if we are to protect the promise of education and its connection to the economy, for your consideration as we move forward within that.
Mr. Chair, and again, I don't disagree with anything you have said, but the overwhelming economic fiscal crisis of this state begs an answer to my first questions. I would hope you would prepare for the worst so that if we somehow found a little softer way of doing this, we would ease the state out. But if we don't know how bad it is, how do we try to fix it?
Chair Nunes.
That's right.
Without a doubt, the $6.2 billion deficit is absolutely devastating right now. We have to correct that course. Education in our systems have received a reduction along with our financial aid programs. Of course, our agency would be prepared and thinking through worst-case scenarios. What you have before you is a budget that lays out the best-case scenario of how we can retain that quality system that we have and provide for our students the two concerns, the rising cost of tuition coupled with their financial aid packages. Clearly, if we look over the page with the $18.2 million programs, all of those programs provide a critical support to the students. We would essentially have to look deeper at those.
Well, Mr. Chair, one
final Pawlowski.
I would hope higher ed, both Minskew and the University of Minnesota and your office, would for once stop the edu speak and start talking to us in the painful reality of the fiscal situation that this state is in. EduSpeak isn't going to solve the problem. We have to know the consequences of what's going to happen here. And that's all I'm requesting. I want to know how bad this can get, system by system, program by program, if there is no new revenue. You don't need to respond.
Hopefully the revenue forecast will help us just a little along the way. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe just to piggyback and represent Pawlowski's comments, you know, the governor during the year's campaign, he actually made a pledge or a promise that he would not cut higher education. And just last night, in fact, the pledge was replayed on the LMAC at the Capitol last night, his pledge. So during the campaign, Mr. Dayton, now Governor Dayton, certainly knew that Minnesota's forecast was going to be a bad forecast. So why is he already breaking this promise? And you might not have an answer for that, but maybe the governor should probably answer that for us. So,
no need for a response if you don't feel it necessary.
Chair Noines, members, the budget before you does recognize the connection that that our education systems, our higher education systems have for that connection to jobs and getting Minnesota back to working again. And that's not EduSpeak, that's just a reality. We are looking at a real need for post-secondary education in the state. This budget protects the vital services in both of those programs, the financial aid to our students, as well as the academic core, which allows the institutions to keep tuition at a minimum. Realistically, anything more than that, and you're looking at faculty layoffs. You're looking at a breach of academic integrity at each of the institutions. You're looking at the U of M possibly losing its national and international perspectives. You're looking at long-term sustainable impact. Good design costs more on the front end, but it pays off in the state on the long run. You're looking at the quality of life of Minnesotans to our youngest citizens, and I've don't know how we can look at our young students and say in the eye and say we can't no longer provide that promise.
Representative Norton, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, these are tough times, and while I understand Representative Detmer's comment, I think the governor's budget has protected education, not just higher education. We do see some cuts here, which I believe we're going to see more cuts from a bill that I assume will be coming from the majority party here very soon. So, you know, this is painful, but it's not as painful as it could be, and I think will be when I see what you guys bring forward. I did have a couple questions that I'm hoping some folks can answer here. I mean, certainly I'm looking at the University of Minnesota Partnership very selfishly for my district and knowing the good work that's being done and our commitment as a state to the bioscience industry. In fact, the Biobusiness Alliance was just in talking about how wonderful Minnesota as a state has done despite the recession. We're growing in this area, outperforming other states, many states who specialize in this area, and I worry that we're jeopardizing that with some of these cuts. The specific questions for the American Indian Scholarship, where you said there's a waiting list, and this is just naivety, so please just bear with me, but I have understood, maybe wrongly, that much of the casino money is put back into education in the form of scholarships. Are there not other pools of money for scholarships for Native Americans based on casino revenue, or have I been misinformed?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Norton, there may well be, but those are never considered within the operations of this program. This program comes, like all the other programs, after the Pell Grant, after the state grant, then on top of it for eligible, you know, Indian children. The casinos may well backfill after that. I'm not aware of that. And as you may recall, I've got conversations around this table in the past, is whether it's casino money or institutional money, they're always the last dollar. the public money always kind of comes first, so it's hard to.
Okay. Yes. Thank you. And if I could.
Representative Norton.
Thank you for that. I think I will look into that a little bit more because I have heard that there's large pots of money out there for scholarships, and if that's the case, it may be redirecting kids, making sure that they know about the other sources, because it isn't state money, it is from an outside source. So there may be some education that could help some of these students that are on the waiting list. The other question was United Family Practice. You know, my concern in this area, and again, I know the governor had some very tough choices to make, and you guys as in the budget office do as well, but part of the health care reform was predicated on making certain we have more people in family practice, and we quit relying on folks into specialty areas where, you know, it's more expensive, it increased health care costs with more specialties and less medical home and family care. So this is a pretty significant cut. It's completely eliminating a program. And I just wondered if you've had those discussions, if they feel there's extra money or other monies out there, that this isn't going to be a problem. But as I recall, in the health care committee, we talked about this being part of the success of the health care reform is getting more people into family care and general practice. So just wonder if you had those discussions.
Representative Norton. We've not had those discussions directly with United Family, with the clinic itself, because obviously the government's budget just came out yesterday, and none of these things were made public. This would affect the last contract we had with them actually for the current fiscal year, about 18 family practitioner residents. So, and two others that I think are doing other kinds of work. There are still other programs out in publicly funded down in, I think, down in Rochester actually. St. Cloud, I believe, still has one, and I'm not sure about the University Twin City campus still. So there's other subsidized programs out there for residency programs that are still, I think, operating not affected by the budget.
Ms. Wright?
Chair Nornes, a representative. The key to keep in mind, too, is that when we were looking at the $18.2 million, the programs that were listed here are either in their early stages of development. They were wonderful ideas, outstanding ideas, either early stages of development or did not have some of the yield that we could or were expecting. So over time, they might have done an enormous service to the state. However, they weren't at their greatest productivity as of yet. So naturally, if we pull from the extremities in order to protect the core, that's one of the reasons why the staff and I decided that those were areas that we could probably have a reduction in.
Representative Norton.
And thank you. I do appreciate that. And part of, I guess, my concern here is we're working in silos. And if this is a silo that the Health and Human Service Committee talks about growing and we're going to have savings from it, but it's being cut in another silo, I just want to make sure that I can certainly share this when I get to the Health Care Committee, but I just want to make sure the different silos know what the other is doing, because it could impact what we're counting on as cost savings down the road. So I really appreciate that, and it's a difficult job. Thank you for your work.
Representative Dipke.
Yes, thank you very much. Partnering on Representative Norton's question about the American Indian Scholarship Fund and other revenues of resource, when we talk about other fund revenues, I see that there's a zero in each one of these. Does that mean that you're not getting any private funds, or it doesn't seem to reflect people who have donated scholarships or have given funds to the school, ongoing funds, have an endowment to the university for the American Indian students?
Mr. Chair, members, I mean, this, what we've presented here is just the budget itself for you to consider for appropriation purposes. Many of these programs may well. In fact, I'm sure the ICAP programs get funding from other sources. The Windows Compact gets funding from other sources, but this is simply the general fund budget that's in front of you.
The reason why I'm asking that is that I think it would be very helpful to know when you're putting together the information for Representative Pawlowski, if you're going to be doing that, to see where we are getting endowments and other things for the university for these scholarships. I think that's very important, because I do know that there are many people that give endowments to the university in certain areas, and I think that including that so that we know exactly how we're what it's going to look like from what he asked. I thought that was a very good question he asked, by the way.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Detmer, a couple of weeks ago we voted on the first cut bill, and if I recall the argument by the majority caucus, it was that this was just the beginning, $1 billion of $6 billion. And then the $1 billion were of the $6.2 billion you need to address. If I'm not mistaken, and Mr. Berg can correct me if I'm wrong, you cut out of here $185 million. And so to hear you go after the governor because he cut 152, and this is his total cut, you would have had five more cuts to make to get to $6 million. So would you have cut $185 million five times? I don't know the answer to that, but it does show all of us on this committee the seriousness of this problem. And, you know, the King and I agree over there on a lot of things, and I'm sure the King and I don't want to see 185 times 6 come out of this committee. I don't recall Governor Dayton's comments on higher education. You know, I was out there on the campaign trail with him, Representative Detmer, trying for the same job for many, many months, and the only thing I remember Mark Dayton saying continuously and on course and on target was, I'm going to make taxes in this state fair, and I'm going to raise taxes on the wealthiest people who are going to help us out. And that's what he did with the budget the other day. But, you know,
Mr. Chair,
I do want to just go ahead, Tom. Yeah.
No, he did make the comment that he was going to raise the funding for higher ed. And it was, and I don't know what your position was when you were running, but that's what that was his position.
I was going to raise taxes on everybody in this room who's got a job. So, and but Mr. Chair, be that as it may, if I could, I do want to pursue Representative Pelosi's question to Commissioner Wright I see folks in the audience from the Minsky system and the university, and maybe what they could do is tell us what a budget would look like for those institutions also if this was done with $6+ billion in cuts. If we could see a worst case scenario like Representative Pawlowski had asked for. I do have a specific question for you though, probably for Mr. Michikanis, since you're new. Do we call you commissioner? I don't know what that full-fledged position is. Right. But anyway, who made the decision on work study to go after it? Because, you know, I've always liked the idea of students working a little bit and getting rewarded for it. And, you know, I've worked hard since I was a little kid, probably too hard with my body and not enough with my mind, although maybe that's because I'm strong like a bull and smart like a tractor. But, you know, to see that 33% cut in that program is a little too much for me to even try to absorb. And so, Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, too, we get to go over this, and the majority of us on this committee get to decide how to manipulate these numbers on here. I mean, we can work with the governor's number, and if this is the number we end up with, and I hope it isn't any worse than an $18 million cut. Be that as it may, if it were this, we can move things around in that budget. And so maybe you can answer that question, and maybe would a prorated, a not-so-big a hit on the work study and just spread that back out into the... if you spread... Let's say we spread the whole $9.7 million back into the state grant program, what would that cut mean to the person getting the least amount of a state grant when they get up to that $50,000-$60,000 income level, and the person getting the most whose family has the poorest incomes? What would that mean if we spread it? Is it $10 a month? Is it, you know, $100 a year? Can you tell us that so we can make those kind of decisions at the end of the session?
I'm not sure.
Chair, Representative Rukavina, let me not venture a wild guess off the top of my head here. But, you know, this would be on an annual basis if you cut that in half. The 9.7 is, you know,
right,
roughly 4.5 or so. And against around across 83,000 grant recipients right now, that would be the math. Recall, though, from our conversation just the other day, is that we're already going to be rationing the state grant program to begin with for the current biennium. So we'll get back to you about a more exact number if I could.
And, Mr. Chair, the rationale behind the that 31-third cut?
Mr. Chair,
was that the office or the governor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, at the end, this is all the governor's decision, all the governor's decisions. We, of course, went through some scenarios for him that we started back in October. And you could say, frankly, the $18.2 million is a given. And that's what you have to find within these programs. And our priority has always been the state grant program. That's, I think, always been the case for this agency. And after that, there's not many other places to go. So if you try to prioritize and maintain the state grant program, you're not left with many choices.
We have some other folks on the agenda, too. We'd like to move a little further along here today, if we can. Representative Banyan?
Thank you very much, and thank you, Representative Rukavina. It sounds like the governor's revenue proposal has an author now. I was a little worried it was going to be an orphan. So I'm glad to hear that there are folks out there willing to support it. That sounds good to me. I want to ask Not for you? No, oh, that's too bad. It'd be a shame for it to be an orphan. It really needs some love. So I wanted to ask a question though about sort of the philosophy of this. As I'm reading through this, and we just got this, you know, 45 minutes ago, so I'm trying to read fast. I'm sensing that there may be a philosophy or sort of a guiding principle in this. One of the things you say about work study, reading on page 15 of our books, is that some colleges, universities can increase student employment from institutional funds. I can tell you, as a professor at St. Cloud State, I hope that's right. I don't know that that's right. I'm a little worried that that's not going to happen. And then it also before just above that says students who do not receive earnings from state work study jobs may work more hours in off campus jobs. I can tell you, my students are working a lot off campus. It's a struggle for them, and I mean that's one of my motivations in how we talk about this, and where I think Representative Rukavina and I do have some commonalities in what we believe. It's tough. As you go through the budget, are you in fact looking for places where you think the money can be replaced by other activities? Are you looking at the incentives, and does that explain really why state grant seems? It seems like every one of these rationales starts with a sentence: "This reduction is recommended as part of a plan to address the projected state budget for shortfall and preserve the state's primary need-based grant program available." The state grant program. Why is that the ditch you want to defend so strongly? And does that tell us anything about these other programs as well?
Ms. Wright.
Chair Nornes, members, the state grant program provides for the greatest number of citizens in the state, over 80,000 annually. It has sustained the test of time. It can, as we heard on Tuesday, maybe have some examination of our policies for updating. Nonetheless, as we also heard on Tuesday, it impacts the greatest number of citizens, especially those from lower middle class families. The decisions in the $18.2 million area were not easy as well. And a number of factors went into that. The staff have had ongoing conversations based upon their experiences and conversations with the university sector. Where that ends, of course, is your decision. Nonetheless, the greatest place in order to protect that core program for the students, we have to pull from those extremities.
Representative
Bennett. I'll just one follow-up, because I know you have other folks to testify for us today. So let me ask this maybe in a different way, because I understand the desire and respect the state grant program. It's been very useful. Have you done any study of how students respond to changes in the various programs so you can see the responsiveness of them to work study versus the Achieve scholarship versus the state grant in terms of both how many classes they take, what happens to their credit-taking behavior, how many of them just leave the university, how much longer does it take for them to graduate, and so on.
Mr.
Chair and members, we have not undertaken a study like that. Obviously, it would be very useful. We have done some work on the impact of the state grant on retention from year to year, and it does prove to be very important. We've also just recently looked at some work on the impact of the state grant on student debt, and that appears to be a very important factor. But we've not done the kind of evaluation that you, as an economist, I'm sure would.
Yeah, and so thank you, Chair Norris. But nothing on the other programs, only on the state grant program. Do you have that kind of information?
Mr. Chair, members, only on the state grant.
I really wish we had the rest of it, but thank you. Thank you.
Trista Grimes is on my agenda. Does she want to add to this? She does not. Well, she does.
Mr. Chair, the idea just was that I was here to answer questions.
Okay, so. All right. Just wanted to be sure. Then I think we move on. I believe, thank you very much for your, okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, Director Wright received a letter from the chair a week or so ago requesting some information on state operating, the office's operating expenditures, budget items, complement, things of that nature. And the Department of Management Budget got involved in this. We were asked to make a presentation today, and what we brought before you in the form of this 5 or 6 page document is a set of data tables that I hope are responsive to your request, Mr. Chair, perhaps not completely, but fairly comprehensively. And I could quickly go through for members exactly what's in here so you have an understanding of that, and then simply happy to answer questions.
Please go ahead.
The first page simply shows where the money comes from for the agency and where it goes. The top pie chart, most of our money, of course, is general fund, but the loan capital fund, that's the fund out of which we make the self loans to students, is significant. The special revenue fund is there to fund our regulatory programs, and then we have a number of federal grants. And you can see on the bottom where the money goes by some categories, mostly grants to individuals or loans to students. And again, I'll just, Mr. Chair, if I may go through this quickly to explain to the members what's in here. Then on the second page is another, just on the general fund side, not all funds, is a spending category. On the bottom of page 2, we were asked to convey to you attorney general costs over the last 10 years. That's listed there going back to fiscal year 2001. In a summary for both the general fund, the special revenue fund, again, that's the regulatory side, and the loan capital fund. At the top of page 3 is balances forward between fiscal years 10 and 11. And again, there's fairly broad authority that's in the rider language that's typically contained in the bill to allow us to carry forward both program, and there's general statutory language on administrative carry forward. I want to point out for members, just because it's such a large number on this table, the state grant carry forward, the $5.88 million, is money that, because of the Achieve issue last year, was moved between fiscal years. That is money that will all go out to students in fiscal 11. No student will be harmed because of this movement between money between fiscal years. So it's simply carry forward, but it simply will all go out to students this fiscal year. At the bottom, page 3, then, is a list of FTEs. By fund, by level. So you have division directors down through the OCHE professional staff and commissioner across all the funds. Again, this was contained in your letter, Mr. Chair. Another question in that letter was internal transfers between 10 and 11. And frankly, there was just a couple, the state grant and Achieve transfers that occurred last year. And then there are some transfers to the governor's office, and finally the college savings plan to the reciprocity. I indicated that a bit earlier. The current year, we moved $740,000 over there in order to maintain that commitment to the North Dakota payment. On page 5 is a history of the FDE by fund going back to the year 2001, 10-year history. You can see how that's changed over time. And we've tried to, in that bottom half there, provide an explanation of what's occurred in a narrative so you can kind of, it tells the story of the changes in the numbers. Then on page 6 then, one of the questions was budget by object code. This is a budgeted numbers. These are not spending numbers for the current fiscal year. They're as of 12/31 because we do make adjustments through the year. But you see the full list of object codes across all the funds. Again, this was a request by the chair. And again, there's lots of information there for you to digest, but we can answer questions at any time. On page 7 is a summary of the fiscal of the federal funding for the agency. The largest one is for the gear up, but we have a number of other federal funds that we receive from the federal government that are listed there. And then the last two pages, 8 and 9, simply explain what those various federal programs are so you get a sense of them. So again, Mr. Chair, this was our attempt to respond to the letter that you had sent, to convey as much information as we could. We'd be answered happy questions because there's a lot of information here.
We appreciate. I mean, this is exactly what we were looking for, and it took a lot of time, I'm sure, to put it together. So we appreciate you doing that. Members have questions? Representative Pulaski.
Just one more follow-up on my other question. I have twice eliminated your office under previous governors, and the third time it was reconstituted with legislation from Representative Seifert and myself. If the budget scenario that we get has no increase in revenue, can you present to this body what we would absolutely have to keep in your office, absolutely have to keep, and I'm assuming most of that would be federal transfer, in order to maintain that federal transfer? If we got down to a point where we had no new revenue and your office was one of the things that we would have to dramatically downsize, can you present that to this committee? Not today, but can you?
Not today.
No time certain, just when you, you know, take the weekend off first.
Thank you.
So, thank you for the request. And do the best you can. Any other questions from the members of our panel? If not, thank you very much. Is there a... Bill? Yeah. Bill DeJong? Or is there a Bill here? There. You wish to present? No. Okay. Seems to be the end of our agenda. And it's been lively, and appreciate your calls, your comments and discussion and attention. Again, the books are yours to take with you or leave them here. It's your choice. Just remember to bring them back if you take them back to your office. So other than that, our meeting is adjourned.